Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Uma. If you're a small business owner, now more than ever, you understand the importance of being able to adapt so you can always be there for your customers. Uma Office is a cloud-based business phone service that gives small business owners the flexibility needed to run a business efficiently from anywhere. With features like mobile and desktop apps, a virtual receptionist, and call recording, you can do more for less. Uma Office starts at $19.95 per user per month with no contracts. To learn more, go to uma.com or call 833-TRY-OOMA.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 19th of May. Our main stories: President Trump says he's taking hydroxychloroquine to protect against the coronavirus, despite medical warnings about its safety. The US Health Secretary has launched a stinging attack on the World Health Organization at its annual assembly. And France and Germany have agreed a proposed EU recovery fund should issue grants rather than loans to countries badly hit by COVID-19. Also in the podcast, we hear about the first positive results from a human trial for a coronavirus vaccine.
This morning, we were very pleased to announce all subjects who had received two doses of our vaccine had seroconverted to develop antibodies in their blood that bound the virus.
So how optimistic should we be? Less than a month after he was ridiculed for suggesting disinfectant as a treatment for COVID-19, President Trump has said he's taking an anti-malaria drug to prevent coronavirus, even though medical experts have warned against it. The US Food and Drug Administration says hydroxychloroquine should not be taken outside hospitals because of the risk of serious heart problems. But President Trump says he's been taking it for the past week and a half.
A lot of good things have come out about the hydroxy. A lot of good things have come out. The frontline workers, many, many are taking it. I happen to be taking it.
Hydroxychloroquine?
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine.
The announcement prompted a stir among the reporters who wanted to know more.
I would have told you that 3-4 days ago, but we never had a chance because you never asked me the question.
Did the White House doctor recommend that you take that? Is that why you're taking it?
Yeah, White House doctor. I didn't recommend. No, I asked him, what do you think? He said, well, if you'd like it. I said, yeah, I'd like it. I'd like to take it. A lot of people are taking it. A lot of frontline workers are taking hydroxychloroquine. And there's a very good chance that this has an impact, especially early on, as a preventative. So I'm taking the two, the zinc and the hydroxy. And all I can tell you is, so far, I seem to be okay. And it seems to have an impact. And maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But if it doesn't, you're not going to get sick or die. I was just waiting to see your eyes light up when I said this, but, you know, when I announced this. But, yeah, I've taken it for about a week and a half now, and I'm still here.
Our correspondent in Washington, Cathy Kay, watched it unfold.
The president was at the end of a meeting that he'd had with restaurant workers. He was there with the vice president. He took questions from the press. And then suddenly, just at the end of this sort of press availability, dropped this news that he says he is taking hydroxychloroquine. He said he asked his doctor about it and his doctor said, would you like to? Which seems kind of curious medical advice in itself. And the president said, yes, he would like to. And as you heard there, he says that as of a couple of weeks, he's been taking this drug. Now, this is the drug, of course, you'll remember that President Trump was pushing quite hard as a possible cure for the coronavirus, but which since then, the administration's own medical officials have come out with studies showing that it doesn't help people that have the coronavirus. And in fact, it can hurt them and lead to heart attacks. What's even odder about the president saying that he's taking it is that he himself has never spoken about it as a prophylactic, as something that would prevent you catching the virus. And he said in this same press availability that he is tested frequently. He is negative. He's tested repeatedly negative for the coronavirus. So it begs a whole host of questions. Why is he taking it if it's not a prophylactic? Why is he taking it if his own medical advisors are that it doesn't actually work and could potentially be harmful? And interestingly, just after the back of that, if you listen to Fox News here, which is generally supportive of the president of the White House, the anchor on Fox News came straight out of that press briefing saying, this can kill you, we warn you. It was a warning that he gave, very frankly, hydroxychloroquine can kill you, you shouldn't be taking it.
Cathy Kay in Washington. For weeks, President Trump has been lashing out at China and the World Health Organization for their response to the coronavirus. Now, at the WHO's annual assembly, the American Health Secretary, Alex Azar, has accused the two of allowing the pandemic to spin out of control.
There was a failure by this organization to obtain the information that the world needed, and that failure cost many lives. In an apparent attempt to conceal this outbreak, at least one member state made a mockery of their transparency obligations, with tremendous cost for the entire world.
The online meeting was attended by the WHO's 194 member states. In his remarks, the Chinese President Xi Jinping insisted his government had acted responsibly, and he backed calls for an investigation into how the outbreak had been handled around the world.
China supports the idea of a comprehensive review of the global response to sum up experience and address deficiencies. This work should be based on science and professionalism, led by the WHO and conducted in an objective and impartial manner.
I heard more about the US intervention from our global health correspondent, Tulip Mazumdar.
Well, it was pretty scathing, wasn't it? I mean, clearly there's been a lot of mudslinging between China and the US for several weeks now, and the World Health Organization seems to have been caught up in the middle of it all, culminating a few weeks back in the US withdrawing funding from the World Health Organization. But right up until the US started talking, actually, countries had come to the microphone. It was a virtual meeting, so everybody was doing it from their own respective countries, and mostly showing a lot of support and solidarity for the WHO. There have been calls, in fact, by South Korea and Australia to give the WHO more powers. Remember, the WHO is an advisory body only. It can't force countries to share information. It does so by diplomacy. And so that is why there have been calls to give it some more teeth, to go into countries to investigate outbreaks early on, which many countries say should have happened much earlier, with WHO going into China, which it did, but not until a little bit later and not independently. It was alongside Chinese officials.
Yeah, you mentioned information. The White House has said in the past couple of hours that China has a responsibility to give more to the WHO. I thought China had shared quite a lot of stuff. What does America want?
Well, both China and the WHO have said that actually it has been very open and transparent from the start. Now, it's not just the US. There have been a number of other scientists and countries criticising China, saying it hasn't been as transparent as it could have been. And from the WHO's perspective, they say that the WHO has been too effusively praising of China. But it did give the genetic sequence, the genetic code for this virus, pretty early on, which helped other countries come up with tests, start working on vaccines. And that's generally been seen as, yes, the China did well there. I think there is a bigger geopolitical fight happening between China and the US, and this issue has been caught up in all of that. And countries all around the world, after the US spoke at the World Health Assembly, they did start talking a little bit more about, you know, not politicising this outbreak. This is a pandemic that has infected more than 4.5 million people. More than 300,000 people have died. We're still, for some countries, at the beginning of this crisis, and we don't know how long it's going to go on for. So the World Health Organization and China have said there should be an investigation. China has said that it should happen after the pandemic has been brought under control. But many countries are saying that should happen after this pandemic has been dealt with.
Tulip Mazumdar. Well, although China and some other nations appear to have got their COVID-19 outbreaks under control, the world will only be able to declare victory once a reliable vaccine has been found. A number of different trials are underway, most at an early stage, but one US biotech firm is reporting promising results. Moderna says its experimental vaccine appeared to produce an immune response similar to that seen in patients recovering from COVID-19. The firm's president, Dr. Stephen Hoge, says it's an encouraging sign.
All subjects who had received two doses of our vaccine in the first two dose level cohorts had seroconverted to develop antibodies in their blood that bound the virus. Those same antibodies that those people had developed actually could neutralize the virus and prevent its ability to infect human cells. We're very pleased by that result because it suggests we're on the right path with this vaccine.
So how significant is this? I asked our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
It's both really significant and not very significant all at the same time. So it's the first human trial that has shown any benefit at all from vaccination. So that makes it feel really significant. But it's also worth remembering at the same time that what this trial is, it's a safety trial. The purpose of the trial is to make sure that it's safe to give this vaccine to people. It appears to be safe. They've got an idea of what the best dose to give might be as well. However, this trial hasn't proven that these people are immune, and so after they've been vaccinated, that they can't get coronavirus, they can't get sick from it, because that requires much bigger studies. So it's one of these exciting first steps or early stages, but it's by no means definitive proof that we have a coronavirus vaccine.
So it only showed that they had antibodies similar to people who'd recovered. And of course, we don't know if those people who've had COVID-19 are immune.
Yeah, so there's all these big arguments about immunity. There are some promising signs in this particular one, because they're looking at a specific type of antibody, what's known as a neutralizing antibody. And they're the ones that actually completely disable the virus. So the presence of those is a very good sign. But there's a lesson. There's another vaccine trial that's done some monkey research. It's one based at the University of Oxford. And it's shown that in that trial, well, in deep inside the lungs, the vaccine would seem to be working very well for the monkeys. It was stopping them getting pneumonia, but it wasn't stopping them having the virus in their nose. And so they were still presumably able to spread the virus. So it's one of these things where you just need to study a lot more people to really get to the bottom of all the nuance of how protective it is it. But be in no doubt, this is very good news.
So when will we know if it works? And if it does work, when will people be able to get it?
So the next stage is probably going to start around about July. So they're just trying to work out what the best dose is. And so this trial is still ongoing. There's another one running at the same time. But the big one is aiming to start in July. And the point of that is that you vaccinate quite a lot of people, and then they go about their day-to-day lives, and you leave it a couple of months, and then you see whether the group that has been vaccinated has fewer cases of COVID-19 than the people who haven't been vaccinated. That's when you finally get to know if it works. Now, I can't give you an exact timescale as to when we'll know for sure, because the more we're successful at suppressing the virus, you know, in every country around the world, the less of it is that's going around, the harder it is to do vaccine trials to work out if they're effective. So, you know, there might in the future, I don't think we're going to get it yet, but there's some discussion about whether you might deliberately infect some people with coronavirus after immunizing them to see then for certain whether it's protective or not. But that can be a risky thing to do. It's a quite delicately balanced ethical decision.
James Gallagher. Even with a vaccine, it will take a long time to get the world's economy back on track. But France and Germany have now agreed on a proposal for a European recovery fund worth more than $500 billion for the countries worst affected by coronavirus. The money will be given out as grants rather than loans. Here's our Berlin correspondent, Jenny Hill.
Angela Merkel, who along with the leaders of other northern European countries had rejected the taking on of shared debt, appears to have struck a compromise with Emmanuel Macron. He's led demands for so-called corona bonds to swell the coffers of poorer member states. The leaders proposed the European Commission borrow €500 billion from the financial markets. The money, which would be repaid in the long term from the EU budget, would then fund the worst affected regions and industries. Angela Merkel said this was an extraordinary plan for an extraordinary time, but also stressed it was a one-off measure.
Jenny Hill. For gardeners, the Chelsea Flower Show in West London is one of the highlights of the year. But like many other events, it's moving online because of the coronavirus. It's the first time since the Second World War that people won't be able to physically visit the garden designs. Daniela Ralph reports.
The smell and feel of the real thing are missing. But Virtual Chelsea is trying to bring the flower show into people's homes. The florist Simon Lysett is doing an online masterclass.
I'm lucky now to be filming this during lockdown in my tiny London garden, where I've been able to seek solace and relax and plant some seeds, because isn't gardening the biggest sign of hope?
The gardener and broadcaster Monty Don takes the online audience on a tour of his own garden. For him, gardening has been vital in recent weeks.
More and more people are finding that gardening of any kind is really helpful. It reduces anxiety, it helps depression, and it's to do with nurturing something.
The Queen has been at almost every Chelsea Flower Show during her reign. In a letter to the Royal Horticultural Society, she said she hoped people would find the virtual show enjoyable and interesting. Buckingham Palace also revealed the royal family's favourite flowers, including Lily of the Valley for the Queen, Delphinium for the Prince of Wales. The Chelsea Flower Show is a gardening and social highlight for many. Virtual Chelsea hopefully fills the gap until the planned return of the show in 2021.
Daniela Ralph. Still to come on the podcast.
I'm Joseph Hammond, 95-year-old Second World War veteran. Now we are faced with another invisible war, COVID-19.
The Ghanaian war veteran joining the fight against the coronavirus. Some other news now, and the US Attorney General William Barr has said that a Saudi Air Force officer who last year shot dead three people at a naval base in Florida had been in touch with a suspected member of Al-Qaeda. Investigators bypassed security features to unlock Mohammed al-Shamrani's phones. From Washington, here's Aleem Makbul.
It was in December of last year that Mohammed Saeed al-Shamrani, a Saudi national and student at the Naval College in Pensacola, opened fire in a classroom, killing three people before he himself was shot dead. U.S. Attorney General William Barr says it's now been revealed from the gunman's phone that he apparently had significant connections to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the group that earlier this year said it had indeed been behind the attack. But Mr. Barr was also highly critical of the phone's manufacturer, Apple, who he said had not helped the FBI in accessing its contents, saying the company's stance on privacy had what he called dangerous consequences for public safety.
Aleem Makbul. Burundi is set to hold general elections this week to choose a successor to the controversial president Pierre Nkurunziza after 15 years in power. Campaigns have been marred by violence and the government has been accused of human rights violations in its effort to hold on to power. The BBC's Ferdinand Amondi reports.
On May 20th, at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, Burundi will choose its next president. There have been huge rallies with zero social distance. Current President Pierre Nkurunziza says Burundians would be protected by God from the pandemic. Amidst this lack of concern from the virus, it came as a surprise when the same government released a statement last week requiring external election monitors to be quarantined for 14 days, effectively locking them out of the polls. The move comes as no surprise to independent observers. Neleke Van De Waal is a director with Crisis Group, an independent organization.
What we've seen in Burundi over the past few months is that the political space is fairly limited. So it's highly questionable whether the elections that are scheduled for the 20th of May, whether they will be free and fair, and whether people will be able to cast the vote for their preferred candidates. The fact that no election observers will be allowed in the country to see what's going on, I think that increases the risk for election fraud, corruption, human rights violations in the run-up to the elections as well.
There are seven candidates running for president, but only two are seen as contenders. Evariste Ndayishimiye, the Secretary General of the ruling party CNDD-FDD, and Agathon Rwasa, leader of the main opposition party CNL. Both are confident they have the support base needed to win. But it's been an uphill battle for Rwasa. Human rights organizations say the government has used its might to intimidate and repress the opposition and its supporters. According to Human Rights Watch, there have been at least 67 documented killings, including 14 extrajudicial executions in the last 6 months. There have also been disappearances, cases of torture, and over 200 arrests against real or perceived political opponents. The security forces have been accused of using excessive force to shut down opposition activity. Independent media have been shut down, barred from broadcasting in Burundi, or harassed into self-censorship. In January, four journalists were jailed for 2.5 years for their coverage of a rebel attack. President Nkurunziza will be retiring with a $530,000 payoff, a luxury villa, and lifetime salary when he leaves office. He will also be elevated to the title of Supreme Leader after he steps down. In 2015, he threw the country into a constitutional crisis when he reigned for a third term. The move sparked violent protests by opposition supporters, which morphed into reprisal attacks. Last year, a UN commission accused the government of human rights abuses, including executions, arbitrary arrests, torture, and sexual violence, charges they denied. The Burundi government has declined repeated requests for comment from the BBC. But the police spokesperson recently said that most cases of violence and crimes were committed by opposition members against the ruling party. The World Bank estimates that about 7 out of 10 Burundians live below the poverty line. The next president of Burundi carries the hope of 11 million people expecting the next years will be better than the last.
Ferdinand Amondi reporting. Scientists have discovered that structures on Mars, which appear to be formed from lava, may in fact be eruptions of mud. The researchers from the Open University here in the UK also found that under certain conditions, the mud flows can appear to levitate. Our science correspondent is Jonathan Amos.
If you have fancy lab equipment, you try to keep it clean. But Open University researchers have inquisitive minds. Their Mars chamber reproduces the planet's usually cold temperatures and low atmospheric pressures. And when they poured a muddy fluid down a slope inside this chamber, they got a shock. Instead of a smooth flow, like you'd get pouring gravy onto a dinner plate, the muddy mix turned ropey and jagged. And for a simulated rare warm day on Mars, the mud would even jump up in the air. It all comes down to how Martian conditions make water rapidly evaporate, boil, and ultimately freeze. The chamber's mud flows actually resemble certain types of lava flow on Earth, and that could now complicate the satellite identification of Mars' surface features.
Jonathan Amos. The veteran French actor Michel Piccoli has died at the age of 94. He was one of the great figures of French cinema, appearing in more than 200 films across almost 70 years. Michel Piccoli became famous internationally after appearing alongside the young Brigitte Bardot in the 1963 film Contempt.
Ma bouche, mes yeux, mon nez, mes oreilles.
Oui, tout.
Donc tu m'aimes totalement.
Je t'aime totalement, tendrement, tragiquement.
Well, I heard more details about Michel Piccoli from our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd.
In France, anyone going to see a film for the last half century, at least, Michel Piccoli was Mr. Cinema. Born in Paris in 1925, first appearances right at the end of the war, never really seen as a glamorous leading man, with maybe one or two exceptions, but a fantastic screen actor. You always believed in him. Then in 1963, Jean-Luc Godard cast him in Le Mépris, or Contempt, which you heard a tiny bit of there, a movie really about making movies, with Brigitte Bardot continually forgetting to put her clothes on, accidentally, of course, which made it a big hit. He was convincing her to love her. It wasn't that thing you used to get in those old movies where, you know, you get the older guy dating the younger woman and you think, no, that would never happen. He made it believable. Far too many films to list, some art house and some very mainstream, most of them, though, very, very good.
Convincing as a lover, but his first wife was well known as well.
Yeah, was there ever a more French couple? Juliette Gréco, the perennially black-clad chanson and cabaret singer, the definition of bohemian glamour in those days, still with us at 93. They were married for about a decade, starting in 1966.
And never typecast.
No, perhaps if you make about 240 films, that's what I counted anyway, you can't be totally typecast. But if you wanted a world-weary police inspector or a middle-aged man amazed to find he was falling in love, whatever doubts you had as a director or producer about the other people in your film, you always knew Piccoli would be as solid as a rock.
For those of us Philistines not au fait with French cinema, who would you compare him to in, say, Hollywood?
We don't have to be totally au fait with every film culture. There is no exact comparison. But I was thinking about this. If you could somehow combine Alec Guinness and Gene Hackman, I know that sounds mad, but that was Michel Piccoli. He was a totally credible movie actor of the very highest order.
Vincent Dowd on Michel Piccoli, who's died at the age of 94. Finally, a Second World War veteran from Ghana is aiming to walk 2 miles, just over 3 kilometres, every day this week to raise money for health workers and fellow veterans across Africa. 95-year-old Private Joseph Hammond, who's using the hashtag WalkWithHammond, hopes to raise $600,000. Richard Hamilton reports.
I'm Joseph Hammond, 95-year-old Second World War.
This YouTube video shows a fairly sprightly Joseph Hammond ambling through the streets where he lives, wearing a protective mask. It was produced by two charities, Forces Help Africa and the Goober Foundation.
To walk 2 miles a day for 7 days to raise funds to kick away COVID-19 from Africa.
Private Joseph Hammond fought in the Second World War for British forces in Burma. Now he's joined the fight against COVID-19 in Africa. He says he was inspired by the exploits of Captain Tom Moore, who completed 100 laps of his English garden and raised more than $40 million for the National Health Service. Joseph Hammond says the money he raises will go towards buying protective equipment for frontline health workers and vulnerable veterans in African and other Commonwealth countries. A Just Giving crowdfunding page has been set up for donations. In November last year, he met the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, Harry and Meghan, as well as other members of the royal family at a festival of remembrance organised by the British Legion.
Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Summer 1940. Adolf Hitler was poised to invade Britain. German bombers struck British factories, airfields, towns and cities.
Could hear this wom.
Stopping the onslaught took a very special plane. The best fighter plane in the world. The Spitfire. Before a plane could save a country, the people had to build it.
The enemy is making preparations for the invasion of Britain. How are we going to meet and overcome this danger?
The plane would be assembled in the communities it was designed to protect. Towns and villages were new Spitfire factories. The planes built by a fresh generation of young men and women. This is the story of the people who built the plane that won the war. Spitfire, the people's plane. A brand new podcast from the BBC World Service. Just search for Spitfire, the People's Plane, wherever you get your podcasts.